Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We're here weekdays from noon to 1 o'clock. You can hear me from 9 a.m. till noon. The Dow is up 167 points right now. NASDAQ up 97. The S&P up 28. Those indices all trading up today, and not up as much as they've been some days, but not down as much as they've been some days, too. We will have a couple of segments on the show today that will deal in part with the president's attempt to maybe control social media companies, notably Twitter. I just want to mention this from CNN. Steve Bertrand talked about it a moment ago, too. President Trump is set to announce an executive order against social media companies days after Twitter called two of his tweets potentially misleading. I don't know how many of you follow the president on Twitter, but I did not think that the phraseology of their warnings was that specific. It was not that critical. And then when you clicked through, it didn't seem very editorial, except that it did go to CNN, for instance, for a fact check. And we know the president is at odds with CNN. I'm not exactly sure what site those click-throughs should land on to try and settle the score over the accuracy of some of the things the president is saying. But CNN might be a red flag unto itself for some of you. I've been wondering if Twitter itself shouldn't be the one that would figure it out and then pass their own judgment. That is, distill from all of the sources that use Twitter what the facts are in this case and then lay them out. People can judge if the president is abiding by them or not. But therein lies the conundrum, doesn't it? Where then do you go for some sort of source that people will say, oh, there's the truth, or at least the bare naked facts, and then I'll decide if the president is on one side of the line or the other? And the same would be true about anybody. Another question I'll have for our guest today is, if that is a private company, then isn't it their business to decide how they run it and who they let play in it anyway? Maybe that's not the case. We'll start with Ian Schur today. By the way, the Dow, I mentioned that a moment ago, NASDAQ up 98 points. I just saw it flip and it didn't flip much. Yeah. Ian Schur joins us, editor-at-large at CNET. And I think that I don't want to get too political. This is a business show, and I think I'll let the politics decide themselves. But is that at least a fair starting point for this conversation, Ian?
I didn't hear the earlier part. I apologize.
Fair enough. We were just talking a little bit here about the president's anger over the way Twitter is handling his tweets. And I think there's two things to consider. If that's a private company, do they get to run it any way they want? But even if they do decide to sort of distill the accuracy of the president's statements, who is the decider in a case like that? Both very challenging for somebody like Twitter, right?
Yeah, it's a really challenging issue for social media in general. I mean, one of the biggest problems that exists is that Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, has often said he doesn't want to be the arbiter of truth. And considering how many times we've caught him not telling the truth, I agree with him. And the challenge that a lot of these social media companies have is that when there's a provable lie shared, particularly by a world leader, what do you do, right? And I'll give you the other end of it, right? I'm not just talking about Trump here, although he does challenge them quite often on their rules just by the way he tweets. But another example is that the United Nations, when they did a study of what happened in Burma, Myanmar, one of the things that they found during that the ethnic cleansing that happened there was that WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook, played a what they called deciding role in the in causing everything to happen. The misinformation shared by government officials on WhatsApp helped to spark the fire that led to so many deaths. So I think the challenge that all of these companies are facing is that that information is not just information. It can be weaponized into something that causes movements in the real world that end up to people dying. And what do you do then, right? And who's responsible and how do you stop it? And I think that's what they're the kind of overarching issue they're all really looking at.
Well, this is already been going in this direction, but then is it an untenable position for social media companies to be neutral? That is, you all use it any way you want. It's up to the users to figure out fact from fiction. That's not going to be a position they can take much anymore.
I think that it's increasingly becoming harder. And we've written on CNET many times. Back a long time ago, when all of these rules that President Trump is now challenging were written, the internet was rather small, and the impact of it was rather small. But we look now, a lot of the really big mass shootings that we've seen in the last couple of years were sparked by people who were following internet ideologies, and they actually posted their manifestos and live video of the shootings on social networks. And I think what we have to kind of grapple with is that social media is not just a place that I share what I ate for lunch anymore. It's actually being used to recruit and cause real-world harm. And, regardless of what you think of what the president says, I think we all have to decide what limits we're willing to put on the way that social media is run and whether or not we want it to be set the same way that we have free speech in the United States. In the United States, we had a Supreme Court case, you may remember, where the question of whether or not Nazis could march in, I think it was Skokie, Illinois, right?
It was, yep.
And so the decision was the First Amendment is more important. But the question is, should we run social media companies the same way? I don't know.
Okay, so pick it up there in a minute. We're talking to Ian Schur. He's over at CNET. He joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch regularly. He's an editor-at-large over there. We've been talking a little bit about the president's dismay with Twitter and what their responsibility will be going forward in monitoring the truth of what he or anybody says. Talk to me about some other nuts and bolts things. Here's a headline from your site, why it's time for you to choose a cheaper phone plan. I think it's always time to choose a cheaper phone plan, Ian. Is something going on right now?
Well, it's more that at the moment we are living in a world where you may have noticed a lot of us are not going outside, and we're actually connected to Wi-Fi a lot. So one of the things to keep in mind is that as we are more homebound, there are actually wireless plans out there that are tailored to people using their phone connections less while still giving them good access. So, for example, we write about various companies like TextNow, Telo, and Ting, which work on the existing networks from Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon. But what they do is that they give you much cheaper access. Oftentimes you pay as you use it, which means that if you're not using it very much, again, because you're not going outside much, you can save a ton of money. And that's really important in the middle of a recession like we're going through. So we actually have a really great list on CNET explaining all the different options out there, the ways that you can really save money, and whether or not you should consider dumping Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint for these cheaper plans.
I have not heard of these companies, Telo, T-E-L-L-O, TextNow, and T-I-N-G, Ting.
Yeah, they're all they are all these companies that actually buy access to Sprint and T-Mobile and Verizon and AT&T's networks and in bulk, and then what they do is they resell it. And what they're able to do is that they're able to offer these different plans that basically use the networks differently. And it's a great opportunity. You may have seen Cricket and Boost Mobile. They have a lot of advertising around the city. Those people are very similar to that. And again, a lot of this is designed to allow people who can't afford the higher price normal plans to have something that's more pay-as-you-go, cheaper, and uses less data and voice while still giving you access to a phone.
Apple is going to open more than 100 stores this week, right?
Yeah, they are really starting to open up their stores. And I think it's worth noting the reason that we talk about Apple and, you know, obviously CNET's a tech site. But beyond that, Apple stores are often the anchors for a lot of the malls that they're in. I don't know about you, but whenever I walked through a mall before this whole mess began, I would see people shoulder to shoulder in the Apple store, right? The rest of the mall could be empty. The Apple store was always full. So the question is, how does Apple, who was one of the first people to raise the concerns about the coronavirus back in February, how do they reopen their stores? And we have a great story on CNET explaining a lot of the things they're doing, including limiting the number of people in the stores. They're going to require that you have a mask on. So it's shirt, shoes, and now mask as well. And how they're really going to make sure that it's safe in those stores, even though they are highly, highly trafficked stores.
Let's talk about HBO Max. What's the news on that front?
Yeah, so HBO Max launched yesterday. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's this new streaming service, as if we don't have enough of them.
Right.
But it's rather expensive compared to all the rest of them. It's $15 a month. You know, if you look at the other ones, you're talking about $7 a month from Disney. It's $9 a month from Netflix, depending on which one you go for, which of their plans. You've got Peacock, Apple's $4.99 a month. So part of the reason that HBO Max is charging so much extra is that not only do they have HBO and Game of Thrones and all that stuff, but also they've got all of this other stuff from the DC Universe, Warner Brothers. So, you know, they've got the Justice League movie, which we could debate is probably one of the worst movies ever made, but hey, they've got it. And they also have Friends, which a lot of analysts and people who watched the stuff said was the most popular thing on Netflix before Warner bought it out. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how the streaming service does and whether or not they're able to convince us all to buy yet another monthly subscription.
I wonder if one of these giant offerings, Disney or HBO or Netflix, I wonder if one of them is bound to fail. Two of them are bound to fail. I mean, just because at some point, as awesome as all of these packages sound, we don't want to do all of them. That's why we're cutting the cable, to save money. If we do all of these awesome offerings, then we'll be back to where we started. Do you have any thoughts about that?
That's actually what the experts always point out to me, is that, you know, 20 years ago we were all talking about breaking up the cord cable companies and cutting the cord, and now we've gotten to a point where we got what we wanted. We get to choose what we want, but if we want everything, then we still end up paying the same amount or more. And I'm really curious to see how it plays out. You know, a lot of the media CEOs I talk to tell me that they expect that at some point, you know, Americans are not going to pay for 40 different subscriptions, and we're going to decide which ones we want. But also, people's tastes are very different. You know, I have no interest in reality television. There's a lot of people who love reality television. And I, you know, because I have no interest, I pay for the stuff that's not reality TV. They pay for the stuff that does. And those, if there's enough people that are split up between all that, maybe it will work. I don't know. But I don't expect anyone's going to have, like, 40 subscriptions. I just don't think that's going to happen.
This sounds so pedestrian, but this jumps out at me, too. CNET.com has 6 truths about your phone's battery life, all about overcharging, overheating, and fast charging. Can you just give me some highlights? What's really important, or maybe what would surprise me to know about my phone's battery?
Yeah, so this is, I don't think it's pedestrian at all. I think a lot of people have misunderstandings about their battery because the technology's changed over the years, and there's also a lot of urban myths out there. So one of my favorite urban myths is that you can actually overcharge your phone if you leave it plugged in too long. Not true. All of the different phones out there and the computers are now designed to actually discharge and charge your battery as they're plugged in. So they actually keep your battery from overcharging while they're plugged in. The same thing is true when you have your phone off the charger. A lot of people think you have to let it go all the way down to zero. It's actually unsafe to do that, so you should never do that. Essentially, you should plug in your phone whenever you can. And I think that that's a lot of people have those beliefs, again, because of old technology and stuff. And the final thing to keep in mind is that you can use chargers from different companies. So a Samsung charger works fine with an LG charger. An Apple charger, if you're using the brick and not the cord, will work with any other phone. It doesn't matter. But you should never buy the super cheap ones from Amazon, because a lot of times those end up being not tested correctly. They could blow up. So you have to be really careful. But as long as you have one that's made well and by a company that you trust, you can use them on any of them.
I'm amazed, though, if I try and buy something simply to charge my iPhone from the Apple Store, the plug-in and the cable will cost me $30. If I go to Walgreens, I can get the thing that does the very same thing for $2.50.
Yes, and a lot of the reason because of that is that if you open up the chargers from Apple and Walgreens, and I'm not defending Apple here, but you can actually look into this, and we've had stories on CNET about it before. If you open up the chargers, the amount of safety stuff built into the Apple one to make sure that it won't accidentally explode or anything, a lot of that stuff is not in the cheaper chargers. And as a result, Apple does charge more, but oftentimes you have a safer device as a result.
Six truths about your battery's life include: high temperatures can damage your battery. That's the fact or the fiction? High temperatures can damage your battery.
Oh, absolutely a fact. I don't know if you've done this, but I've accidentally left my phone on the windshield when I'm driving. And, things cook real quick on that windshield. And I've actually had my phone, it's a screen suddenly gives me a yellow warning sign and says, I'm shutting down because it's too hot in here. And in fact, it can damage your phone to have it too hot or too cold. So there's a certain operating temperature they should all be working in, and most of us live in that temperature. But for those of us who live in extremes, whether it's super hot or we accidentally leave our phone in our cars that bake very quickly, or you are in super cold, let's say you're in Alaska, generally speaking, those places, it's very, very, you have to protect your phone in different ways to make sure that the battery and the electronics don't get destroyed.
More to talk about another day. Ian Schur is the editor-at-large over at CNET. Visit CNET.com. Thanks, Ian. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's 12:35. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Elise Glink joins us Thursdays at this time. Elise, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
Real estate and financial wellness expert, owner of Think Glink Media. Visit thinkglink.com. The unemployment number, good, bad, what's your thought about that today?
Well, I think it's great when you compare it to what's been going on the last 8 weeks, but it's terrible if you look at it historically over the decades. So we saw today, this morning, they released new first-time unemployment claims of 2.1 million. So we're continuing the downward trend, which is great, but it's still a whole lot of people.
So what's the number? It's over 40 now, right?
It is over 40 million, and incredibly, John, I think this really is what bears watching, is that those numbers do not include millions of other people who have been laid off. So it does not include people who have either not applied for benefits or didn't qualify for benefits, and those who have left the labor force entirely. So some of these people are 8 million undocumented workers who are estimated to have lost their jobs. They're not entitled to benefits. New graduates just entering the labor force who got laid off, not entitled either.
Yeah. That's a great frustration for some of my friends, colleagues, family members. That is, the college kid who thought he was entering the best job market in history now doesn't have a job to go to and doesn't qualify for virtually any of these sort of stimulus packages or unemployment benefits. And if they're not living at home, they still need to eat. They still need to find a way. And they haven't earned a paycheck yet. And there's not much assistance for them. The stimulus packages did not really anticipate or think about that.
No, it didn't. And, you know, there are some things that they did think about, right? So for the first time ever in history, people who are self-employed were able to collect some unemployment, which is great. That's been very helpful to people who are 1099'd.
Which is, to me, so I got into this discussion with my family yesterday. I wonder what your thoughts are on Elise. Somebody texted into the show yesterday, they did not qualify for stimulus. They shouldn't have got $1,200, $2,400, or $1. The federal government sent them $450. They said, what are we going to do with it? Terry Savage yesterday said, well, while all along she's been saying they're not going to claw back a lot of these benefits, she said, if you are a conscientious person and want to find a way to give it back, save it for now. And at some point, maybe they will ask for it on an income tax return, or there will be a program. She said, but right now, everybody trying to bug the IRS or Social Security with money going the other way only slows the gears even more. And my attitude generally is that if it's a stimulus check and you just spend it right now, I know you'll be the beneficiary of that, but so too will be the people that get the money. So I'm not going to beat you up for $450 if you just go buy some books online or go to a restaurant.
Yeah, it's a good point, John. I think that if you are going out and spending, it's going to be fine. $450, if you didn't need to get it, if you weren't part of that, if you earned too much, it's possible that they're going to ask for it, but you just have to understand that the numbers are vast, right? $325 million. The IRS is at nearly the lowest point per capita in terms of people, I think, maybe that it's ever been. Right now, they're really focused on the big dollars, the publicly traded companies who took the PPP and maybe shouldn't have. I'm not so sure they're ever going to get around to you and your $450. So go spend it, and if that changes, we'll let you know.
Yeah, and then go find $450. By the way, I don't know that they entirely anticipated the fact that the $600 additional from the federal government is disincentivizing some workers. What are you reading or thinking about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the Fed released its beige book, which kind of looks at where the economy is and all cylinders. And they did come to the same conclusion that everybody else has come to, which is that for a lot of lower-income workers, that extra $600 a week is hugely generous. It may even be more money than they were earning before, right? $500 a week is, you know, a significant amount of money, $26,000 a year. So you tack on a little bit more, and that's sort of the overall year annual run rate of what that $600 would be. And so for a lot of people, that combined with their unemployment check, generous or not, for what they were getting, has made it really comfortable to stay at home and stay safe. And they don't want to give that up so quickly.
Don't some of these benefits expire in July, though?
They do, July 31st. And so the party will come to an end, and hopefully at that point in time, people will go back to work who can. The problem is, there are a lot of people who won't have jobs to go back to. And the question is, how many? Now, we should be looking to the government right around now, actually in a couple of weeks, for the mid-year update to the economic numbers. So you may remember the last time we heard from the government officially, unemployment was going to stay at an all-time low of 3.5% this year, and we were going to see growth of 3.1%. And now we're seeing negative 5+% growth for the year. The GDP second revision came out today as well. And the government's decided to take a formal pass on delivering any mid-year update.
Unemployment is right now 15%. Is that right?
Well, it was about officially at the end of April, it was 14.9%. But there, everybody is expecting it to come in somewhere between 20% and 25%, or even higher when you consider all these other people that don't even count.
I'll let you go, but I think one statistic you laid on us, which has stayed with me ever since, is, tell me if I got this right, Elise, 40% of people making less than $40,000 are unemployed?
That is correct. That was a number from the Federal Reserve a couple of weeks ago, and that is a very, very troubling number, John.
We'll continue to follow the numbers. Hopefully they'll get better. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Elise. Thanks for your time today.
As always, John. Be well.
Elise Glink, you can find her stuff at thinkglink.com. Here's the Wintrust Business Minute on WGN.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. $76 billion. That's the estimated drop in Illinois economic output in a report from the University of Chicago. Blame the pandemic. It says the total job losses could be more than 500,000. Amazon is increasing its grocery store footprint. Crane says it plans to open a store in Schaumburg in a former Babies R Us location. Naperville's on the horizon as well as the delivery giant looks to expand nationwide. And Chicago Inno says a Chicago startup making indoor hydroponic systems just landed some seed money to help you grow your vegetables, fruits, and herbs inside your home. Rise Garden says it raised $2.6 million in a seed round from True Ventures. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
What have you got in the market, Steve?
Green numbers. The Dow's up 198 points, the NASDAQ up 110, and the S&P 500 higher by 32.
Here's an agribusiness report. This is Orion Samuelson.
With the numbers in the grain trade today at the Chicago Board of Trade, wheat doing fairly well. The July wheat contract is up 13¾ cents a bushel. July corn is trading higher today. It's up 2½ cents a bushel. But the soybean market is on the downside today, with July soybeans trading down 2¼ cents a bushel. Livestock futures at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the June lean hog contract, down $3.05 a hundredweight. The June live cattle contract is up 70 cents a hundredweight, and the August feeder cattle contract up $1.90 a hundredweight. And here we go with the first report that I've seen on the state fair season. The Wisconsin State Fair for this year has canceled, and the state fair will be held next year in August at the Wisconsin State Fairgrounds at West Allis. The report I've gotten from the Indiana State Fair is they're continuing to monitor the situation, but have not yet made a decision on whether or not the Indiana State Fair will go, and I'm still waiting for word from the Illinois State Fair on whether or not it will go. Finally, a booklet or an online site you should know about if you live in Illinois, Prairie Bounty. That's a directory of over 900 farms, businesses, and specialty groups across the state. Is available online at specialtygrowers.org/shop local. And if you're a producer in that category, you can get your profile on the website. It's a book of an online site of 900 farms, businesses, and specialty groups across Illinois. And as I said, available online if you want to get farmers market information or other food and crop information. That's where you'll find it, Prairie Bounty. And go to the Illinois Farm Bureau site, and you'll be able to get it there. So that's your money on 720 WGN.
Orion, before you go, real quick, so Wisconsin, no state fair. Indiana, undecided. Illinois, still undecided. And Minnesota has canceled theirs, too, which...
That's a huge one.
Oh,
that's
my goodness.
A huge fair.
Yeah, that's a showstopper that they stopped their state fair. It's hard to imagine that these other ones won't as well, huh?
Yeah, and we're still waiting for Iowa, too. We're checking the states that are closest to Illinois, and so we're still waiting. But I think maybe the fact the Wisconsin State Fair has postponed till next year, that will probably influence the other state fairs that are still taking a look at it.
Well, Orion will tell you when he knows, and if anybody knows, it'll be Orion Samuelson. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
That's the Big O. It's 1246. This is WGN. Now 1249, just watching some of the indices scroll. S&P up 30 points. WGN Radio News in 11 minutes. Remember, Lori Lightfoot, Chicago mayor, set to announce what the opening up of Chicago will look like. And it evidently isn't going to look like or be on the same timetable as the rest of the state. J.B. Pritzker's plan goes into effect the next phase tomorrow. Chicago's not there. Where are we? Lori Lightfoot, you'll hear it live here on WGN after 1 o'clock. Let's listen live to Amy Guth. She's got more business news for us. Hi again, Amy. How are you?
Hi, John. How's it going?
Really good. We were talking to Elise Glink a moment ago, talking a little bit about the unemployment rates and numbers nationally. I think you've been looking at some statewide numbers too, right?
Well, I'm looking at a lot of different sectors of it and kind of how they're sliced up. You know, I think there's a really interesting piece of data that I've been digging into very deeply, and that is a report that has come out of the University of Illinois system. There is a lot of scholars from various, you know, spots and various scholarly disciplines from U of I that have gotten together to do this. And what they have predicted in this report is that Illinois may suffer a $76 billion reduction in its economic output and some 550,000 in job losses by March of next year. So those are very big numbers, specifically the jobs. Let me give a little caveat to that. We've already blown past that number, but what they allowed for was that some of those furloughs and job losses would be temporary. People would find other work. People would go back to their jobs in maybe a reduced role, fewer hours, or a more junior role, something like that. So they kind of feel like the average out this time, you know, next year, not quite a year from now, would be about 550,000 kind of net losses. So those are big numbers. $76 billion is a lot when we're talking about the economic output of the state. Pretty big.
And that's just for the next 10 or 11 months.
That's right. Yeah, that's until March 2021. So, you know, that's kind of one of those numbers. And this, I mean, all this report is so interesting, and there's so many interesting points in it. But a number like that really stops you in your tracks to think about just what a big size that is and how many areas that will be impacting. In particular, they're talking about sectors of industry that will probably be the most hit. And then individual pocketbooks. So what they're looking at is that Illinois citizens and businesses will collectively lose more than $28.5 billion in income. Again, that's their prediction based on the data they have from their various disciplines. So we don't know till we're there, but that's their prediction. And they're particularly saying that's going to come from the restaurant and hospitality businesses, but also construction, transportation, and utility, as well as the government sector. They're going to bear the brunt of some of that, too. I think we've seen that with hospitality. The radiology convention is huge, huge, big money that comes into McCormick Place, and that was just canceled this week for November. That's a huge event, and that's millions of dollars and lots of hotel and overnight stays and things like that. They made the decision to go virtual and move that online. And, I mean, that's not something they've done in their history. That's just a huge event. It's been going on for years, and it's a huge moneymaker. So I know McCormick Place is really feeling that pain, and they're such a big economic driver here in the city. So, you know, I think it's things like that. It's the restaurants, it's hospitality and ancillary hospitality that when people come to town, they take taxis, they go out to eat, they, you know, do tourist stuff and things like that, where we're really going to see those impacts.
I remember talking to the organizers of this Chicago-based housewares show, the first major convention to cancel its plan at McCormick Place, and we were a little aghast and shocked. And we called the woman that was in charge, and she sort of explained it, and it seemed not an inappropriate decision, but also a very proactive one. I won't say heavy-handed, but we weren't where we are now. Now that seems like nothing. I mean, of course you're canceling these things. And the numbers are a little staggering. I didn't know we had $76 billion of economy coming out of Illinois in a year, let alone that we're about to underperform by that amount. That's an amazing number.
That's exactly right. And, you know, and some of that, especially in the hospitality sector, some of that you might not have a choice. You know, when we're looking at conventions canceling, that wouldn't resume fully until phase five of Pritzker's statewide reopening plan. Of course, we're going to hear more about Lightfoot's here pretty soon. But, you know, so some organizers of events may not even have a choice. They'll have to move their events online or postpone them for a while.
That's a good point. I mean, even if you wanted to, even if you felt strong, the state of Illinois wouldn't allow you to have more than 50 people until you get past phase four into phase five. Boeing has laid off still more workers. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we knew this was coming. The leadership had talked about this as a possibility and then as a definite. And so Boeing's laid off 6,770 workers. That happened yesterday. Most of that was in the Puget Sound area of Washington State, mostly engineers. On top of that, though, there have been, prior to that, involuntary layoffs. There were some kind of buyout packages that were offered. And about 5,500 Boeing workers said yes to that. So we're talking about a really big number when we have 5,500 voluntary and then another 6,700 involuntary. These are big numbers. Boeing has been talking about the pain they're in. They're not getting orders from their airline customers because their airline customers are not really flying very much at much capacity right now. So really rough moment in the airline industry. And we're seeing those, you know, the Boeing CEO was very apologetic about it. He said, I wish there was some other way. He sent a note out to workers yesterday that seemed very genuine and very apologetic. But, you know, I think that's where a lot of leaders are right now, having to make some really, really crucial decisions that affect, you know, thousands of people and thousands of households.
I got less than 2 minutes left, Amy. We talked to Ian Schur a little while ago about at CNET, the battle between the president and Twitter. What are you reading or hearing about that?
Yeah, a lot of people are waiting to see exactly what this executive order is going to look like. I think there's a lot of concern about how this will impact Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, because that's really the crux of it. It makes if I go say something ridiculous and false and maybe commit libel on Twitter, Twitter's not responsible for things I say or anyone else. And this might really shift that and potentially open up these tech giants to major, major lawsuits. So I think a lot of people are just kind of waiting to see what that's going to look like and what that's going to be, what that will entail. But I think it's going to call for, or at least usher in, rather, a big shift for the culture of tech companies right now, kind of where they are and how they're used. I really do think it'll have a big impact.
I saw it as described as a legal long shot by the White House, but it doesn't mean they can't give it a try, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think it'll definitely be challenged in court. Who knows how well it will do? But I think it's made a lot of people kind of go, oh, wait, maybe this could go away. I mean, just last night on Twitter, I saw some people going, okay, I'm signing off. Don't know if we'll be here tomorrow, but, you know, let's all connect on another platform. I've seen a couple of people reporting some tech issues. So I wonder, you know, kind of behind the scenes, if people are trying to beef up servers in an unrelated way or roll out a new feature or something to make it a little more valuable to users right now, remains to be seen. But yeah, I think a lot of people are waiting to see exactly what happens with this executive order and how it would roll out and how it would impact people and how soon.
We'll continue to follow it and ask you to do the same. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.